when the school library was empty, and dropping the book out of the window into a yew bush to avoid Miss Devon, who seems to think her job as English teacher included defending the school's books against dirty boys. His fellow pupils would have pilloried any boy for reading a single page more than required, but he had whiled away many a detention in the library, breathlessly following the Trojan Aeneas on his quest to found the Roman Empire. At year's end, and halfway through his third re-reading, he could not bear to leave Aeneas outside the stench-filled cave to the underworld, with the hell-dogs baying at the dreadful Sybil's approach. He had resisted the urge to show Miss Nash the book. Teachers enjoyed their godlike powers to toy with him and punish as they pleased, and he had already let slip too much enthusiasm for Virgil. But he had a strange feeling she would have understood. As he waited and read, he kept one eye on his snares and one ear cocked for any sound of the farmer. Any nailed boots, any cartwheel or snorting of ewes being herded in a mass of hot, oily wool, a collie nipping at their heels. It was not the farmer's time to be in this lane. He was likely harvesting corn in his upper fields, but it was always wise to listen. The farmer had no respect for the track being a public way, and would box the ears of rabbiting boys and threaten them with the constable for poaching. Snout could still feel a blow he had once had from the farmer and being held almost to choking by the collar until the constable was called, and the constable asking for his full name with which he was christened, and the farmer shouting that he was a dirty gypsy and not deserving of the benefits of church. "Richard Edmund Sidley," he had said, the name almost unfamiliar in his ears. Everyone called him Snout, except his mother, who called him Dickie Darling, which was worse than Snout, if there were other boys about to hear. And his father, who called him Son.
"Fancy name for a low poacher," the farmer replied.
And the constable arrested him and hauled him away in his dog cart, taking along one of the two dead rabbits. Near town, the constable gave him a half-hearted box on the ear, not half as hard as his sister or mother could deliver, and told him to run home.
"Lucky for you, we don't hang poachers no more," he said.
"Can I have my rabbit?" Snout asked.
"Course I could send you to the reformatory," the constable said.
Snout took off running and heard the constable calling after him,
"Tell your mother, Arnie Spriggs sends his best regards."
His mother had been a beauty in her day, and many a man in Rye still shook his head in disbelief that she had chosen to marry his father instead. A leaf twitched at the nearest hole. A soft grey nose wriggled and sniffed. Snout held his breath and did his best to quiet the beat of his heart. A bird sang a clear note in the treetops. The leaves of the hedges shivered, and a grey-brown rabbit dashed headlong into the wire noose to fall, writhing in the dirty lane, blood spurting from its neck. Snout wrapped the body as best he could in big dock leaves and put it in his bag. He put the Virgil on top and hoped the rabbit wouldn't bleed all over it. Part 2. War broke, and now the winter of the world, with perishing great darkness, closes in. For after spring had bloomed in early Greece, and summer blazed her glory out with Rome, an autumn softly fell, a harvest home. A slow grand age, and rich with all increase, but now for us, wild winter, and the need of sowings for new spring, and blood for seed. Wilfred Owen, 1914. Chapter 10. It was a late August evening when the refugees came. The sun was lying in a low amber shaft along the high street below, the rooftops and chimney pots still painted in glowing colour, but the houses of Mrs. Turber's cobbled street were already sunk deep in their own shadows. Beatrice had been called to her door by the train whistle and waited, like other householders, in her own doorway. Mrs. Turber stood two doors down with her neighbour, clutching a shawl around her shoulders, as if the arriving refugees had brought the chill of war to the warm evening. Above them, Mr. Tillingham, prevented from going to the docks by the sudden flaring of his gout, stood at the open window of his garden room smoking a cigar. The small group, led by Dr. Lawton and the mayor, came slowly up the cobbles. Despite the doctor's age and the mayor's girth, they seemed regally upright and hearty compared to the refugees, who climbed with great fatigue, heads down and shoulders hunched under shawls or grey donated blankets. Instead of the apple-cheeked children expected by the ladies waiting at the town hall, these were mostly families, the parents and grandparents leaning in one to the other, a hand reaching or a shoulder offered. Three old nuns made a small family of their own in the rear, habits creased and grimy, hands counting their rosary beads. All carried only small, shapeless bundles, as if there had been no time to gather belongings, or as if they had been forced to shed them along the way. Beatrice had not expected the silence. She heard only the scrape of wooden clogs and the wheezing of breath, the strike of the doctor's cane and a low cough somewhere in the rear. It was the same pressing sense of solemnity as a funeral procession. And Beatrice felt her heart clench. A sob broke the silence, a low and plaintive sob, as a young woman carrying a small child raised her face to the brightness above the rooftops. Her shawl fell from her head, revealing a tumble of pale blonde hair and a face as white as bone, save for the blue hollows beneath her eyes. Her dress was dirty and torn about the hem, and yet Beatrice saw it was panelled in thick lace down the front, and her boots, now ruined with mud, were of soft leather with an elegant curved heel. The child she carried wore a rough peasant's smock and clogs. His ruddy cheeks announced that he belonged not to the girl, but to the large family just ahead of her, the mother already clutching a baby and the father keeping his arm around the back of an old woman, bent low under the weight of her years and suffering. Hugh Grange brought up the rear, supporting the shuffling steps of an older man who kept a hand over his eyes, as if he had seen too much and could no longer bear to look about him. As they passed, the neighbours seemed to grow conscious of their own staring and called out welcomes in softened voices. But the tired and stumbling refugees only shrank further into their blankets and quickened away up the hill. Hugh glanced at Beatrice as he passed, and his face seemed to brighten, as if he were glad to see her. He gave her a small nod. Beatrice had decided to keep away from the town hall. Though she was determined to give such free time as she had to Agatha Kent's committee, there were many more ladies than needed to meet the arrivals, and she did not wish to be among the curious with their pressing enthusiasm. Now, however, she felt an urgent need to follow the refugees and assist as she might in their safe billeting. The council room was in some state of uproar when she arrived. Urgent discussions bordering on argument seemed to be going on in many corners, while the seated refugees were attacked from all sides by ladies swinging hot teapots in reckless arcs and pressing huge trays of sandwiches on people who were already holding sandwiches. The lady pounding spirited music hall favourites on the piano was blithely unaware that she was merely adding to the general din. Meanwhile, a small girl dressed in Sunday best, much beribboned about the head and carrying a basket of shortbread, offered her treats to the refugees with the trembling timidity of one asked to pass raw meat through the bars of a lion cage. Beatrice saw Hugh standing apart, eating two ham sandwiches at once. "Sorry to be so rude, but I'm famished," he said by way of greeting. He sounded exhausted. "A very long day and no lunch." "What's happening?" asked Beatrice. "I see some anxious discussions." "We have a number of large families who understandably do not wish to be parted," said Hugh. "Meanwhile, many well-meaning ladies have made meticulous arrangements to take in one or two guests each. Ironic that families who cleaved together through German brutality may be forced asunder by English charity." Mr. Tillingham, a frown of concentration on the great forehead, walked towards them, deep in discussion with an agitated Mrs. Fothergill. "One must open one's heart in the face of this scale of human tragedy," he was saying, a hand patting her arm. "Would that I had more to offer than the limited scope of a bachelor establishment." "We had requested mostly children, But my husband said the people in charge were quite rude about it, said Mrs. Fothergill. She spotted Hugh. Mr. Grange, you were there. Were there no children to be had?
We managed one or two, said Hugh. But as you can see, they came with parents and grandparents attached, and they were unwilling to part with them.
One could also have wished for more genteel folk, said Mrs. Fothergill. She frowned at a man who was noisily drinking from a teacup, held in both hands, and lowered her voice. Of course, we will succour all who need us, but it is quite impossible to ask our ladies to take absolute peasants into their own houses, however charming their wooden clogs.
I'm afraid it was all desperation at the docks, said Hugh. They just sorted us a group, like cutting out sheep at the Wednesday market. And your husband did not like to refuse. I believe the mayor of Bexhill was there collecting a second batch.
Agatha Kent seemed to have quieted most of the arguments, and now approached bearing a sheaf of papers, pen in hand. The farm at New Road will take one family. They have an empty cottage, she said.
Colonel Wheaton has offered a gamekeeper's lodge to hold another, and the Mrs. Porter will take in the nuns until they can receive assistance from their order. Meanwhile, we will just have to remake the Lower Street hostel over to accommodate families instead of boys' and girls' dormitories.
People will be so disappointed, said Mrs. Fothergill. They wished so much to open their hearts and homes.
Perhaps you could give up taking in the accountant and his wife? Asked Agatha, indicating a thin refugee couple sitting very protectively either side of a battered brown suitcase.
You already have so many obligations with the voluntary aid detachment, and there are other ladies wishing desperately to be called.
Let me sink from exhaustion. Yet still will I do my duty, said Mrs. Fothergill. I shall not shirk from the strife.
Is that everyone? Asked Hugh.
I believe so, said Agatha. There may be just a small issue with the professor, whom you offered to take in, Mr. Tillingham.
He's not a charlatan, is he? Said Mr. Tillingham. I picked him out as a man of great intellectual refinement.
It's just that he comes with a daughter, said Agatha, indicating the pale girl Beatrice had noticed in the street. She was still sitting among the peasant family, holding the baby while his mother drank tea. As her fingers played with a tiny hand and the baby reached for her pale hair, Beatrice saw on her white face the same faint smile as in a Bellini painting of the Madonna. It was a look of grace that Beatrice had always thought came from knowledge of events to come, but which she now saw more simply as a temporary moment of quiet solace on a refugee's journey.
"I am not sure a bachelor household is at all suitable for a young woman," Mr. Tillingham was saying. He seemed quite agitated at the thought, as if a young woman would be sure to leave stockings drying in the parlour and walk about in her chemise, shedding hairpins on the carpets.
"If you wish to withdraw, we have others willing to step in," said Agatha.
"No, no, I am called to leadership on this issue on the national stage," said Mr. Tillingham. "I must have my refugee."
"Well, I'm sure your housekeeper can cope with one extra girl," said Agatha. "And Miss Nash is just down the street. I'm sure she would be happy to be invited to entertain the young woman." At this suggestion, Mr. Tillingham seemed to brighten up.
"Perhaps a different solution is before us," he said. "Perhaps the young lady can stay with Miss Nash, and the professor with me."
"Again, they want to stay together," said Agatha.
"But in this case, we are the nearest of neighbours," said Mr. Tillingham. "Why, we might view Miss Nash's quarters as an annex to the garden, and the young ladies would, of course, be free to trip back and forth across the lawn as they please."
With a wave of the hand, he thus disposed of the 12-foot-high brick wall that shut all trace of his sylvan landscape from the street. "I fear I am not the mistress of my own home," said Beatrice, torn between wishing to chide Mr. Tillingham for his high-handed approach and the promise of the doors to his home being thrown open to her at last.
"You and the young lady would also be welcome to the full use of my small library, if you so wish," he said,
as if the offer were a casual afterthought. But she knew it was a deliberate inducement, and she also knew she could not resist. "I would be honoured to do my part, of course, she said. Mrs. Turber shall be compensated from my own narrow pocket, if necessary, said Mr. Tillingham, though I believe large amounts of funds are being raised, he added, looking with barely disguised eagerness at Agatha. Your generosity will show us all the way, Mr. Tillingham, said Agatha. Let us go and talk to the professor.
Ah, Mr. Tillingham does like to insist publicly on his own penury, said Hugh. I believe his sighing garners him 3 or 4 dinner invitations a week.
I suppose the greatest writers are by definition too true to their art to become as wealthy as those who write entertaining rubbish, said Beatrice. Only he does seem to have one of the nicest houses in town.
He does not stint himself alone at home, said Hugh. He is as fond of good claret as the next man. Only when he has guests to dinner, he invariably feeds them mutton and cheap Spanish wine.
I look forward to that, said Beatrice. I have a feeling he and Mrs. Turber may compete to feed us badly. Perhaps I will start saving my bread crusts.
If you become malnourished, I shall undertake to escort you and the young lady to a suitably respectable tea shop and feed you up on scones and cream, said Hugh.
How gallant of you, said Beatrice. I imagine the same invitation would be forthcoming, even if the young lady were less than beautiful.
You must admit she is quite the damsel in distress, he said. My cousin Daniel will no doubt fling himself at her feet, parchment in hand. Hugh seemed gloomy at this prospect, and Beatrice laughed at him. Not to suggest that you are in any way not worthy of a poem or two, he added. I didn't mean to imply.
I am quite beyond such foolishness, and therefore cannot take offence, said Beatrice.
Nonsense, said Hugh. No lady is too old for a sonnet, which is why Daniel still writes them to Aunt Agatha's cook, and always thereby receives the largest slice of Victoria sponge. Victory is ours, said Mr. Tillingham, returning with Agatha. The professor makes no objection to the arrangement.
And Mrs. Turber is more than agreeable to being compensated for a second tenant, said Agatha. So the burden falls on you, Miss Nash. Are you sure you won't mind? She can sleep in my writing corner, said Beatrice. I can squeeze my desk into my bedroom.
I am deep in your debt, young lady, said Mr. Tillingham. You must bring your guest tomorrow to see her father. Not too early, of course. I work in the mornings. I think we should meet for tea, and I will make arrangements for the green parlour to be set aside for father and daughter to meet quietly at any hour.
He looked at his watch and repeated,
Not any hour, of course. I must be able to work.
With that, he swept away to carry off the professor. Beatrice watched Mr. Tillingham, solicitous, and the professor, a little more cheerful, offer a brief farewell to the girl. The girl said nothing, but merely watched her father leave, her hands at her sides, her body leaning slightly, as if invisibly pulled after him, and all the light gone from her face. As the birds announced dawn, the girl in the upstairs cottage bedroom began calling for her papa. Beatrice woke to find her cheek pressed to a floorboard, her arms and legs stiff from sleeping on the parlour rug. She had given the exhausted girl her own bed, helping to remove her ruined boots, and then merely loosening buttons and stays before pulling the clean sheets and blankets over the girl's filthy dress and tucking her in, as she might do for an invalid. She had then taken a quilt and retired to the parlour to sleep on the floor. Now the cottage was cold and dark, her quilt warm. It felt easier not to move, but another moan from above led her to unwrap herself and stumble to her feet. She gathered the quilt around her shoulders like a shawl and crept upstairs. The girl was deep in sleep, but twisted in her sheets, moaning and plucking at the covers with her fingers and muttering in French. Abigail, the maid, was crouched at the bedside, smoothing her hair and trying to straighten the bed linen with one hand.
"There now, you lie still," Abigail was repeating quietly. "You're safe now, and Papa's safe too."
"Does she need a doctor?" asked Beatrice, tiptoeing across the room in her stockinged feet.
"She'll be fine, miss," said Abigail. "My mum has bad dreams sometimes. If you just speak to 'em like they're awake, it seems to calm 'em right down." I don't know that she speaks English, said Beatrice. I don't think it matters, do it now, miss, said Abigail, leaning in to pat the girl's shoulder. Just a kind voice in the dark is all we want most times. The girl gave a sigh and settled more peacefully on her pillow, her face relaxing. Abigail patted her hand and the fingers stopped clawing. You have the touch, Abigail, whispered Beatrice. Can you sit with her a while? I could stay a bit, miss, said Abigail, but I need to get the stove lit soon. I'm thinking you'll be wanting a fire laid under the copper for some bath water, even though it's not bath day. Yes, perhaps you'd better run along and get the copper going before Mrs. Turber wakes up, said Beatrice. That way we don't have to disturb her morning with all this added generosity. I'll bring you some tea, miss, said Abigail. If the lady cries out again, just hold her hand. The girl's hands lay on the covers like fledgling birds. Beatrice remembered how her father's hands, similarly naked and blue-veined, had withered under her touch, and how she had felt the warmth retreat from them even before her father took his last breath. It seemed to Beatrice, in the chilly half-light of dawn, that this moaning girl had come out of that same place of death, bringing its smell and its fear with her, and Beatrice shrank from touching her. She slumped to the floor by the bed, drew the quilt tight around her, and looked hard at the window as if by staring she might urge the sun to quicker life. It was still early when Beatrice went out into the courtyard bearing a large comb, a broad sash of white grosgrain ribbon, and her sewing box. Birds sang in a garden beyond the wall. A white butterfly was looking for milkweed. She could hear the snort and jingle of a horse tossing his head in the street, and smell the peppery scent of Mrs. Turber's tomato plants wilting against sun-heated brick. Amid the sounds and scents of the hot summer morning, the girl sat on a wooden chair in the small courtyard behind the cottage, head bent, allowing Abigail to vigorously towel-dry her hair. After a gentle scrubbing with carbolic soap, the girl had emerged from the dented copper-hip bath in the kitchen as unself-conscious as a child being bathed by its nanny, and allowed Abigail and Beatrice to rub her dry with two of Mrs. Turber's rather rough cotton towels. She had one or two large bruises on her arms and a deeply bruised cut on her thigh, which was scabbing over but red and black around the edges. Beatrice sent Abigail for a bottle of iodine, and they soaked the wound, the girl crying out only once as the iodine stung. When it was a dry purple stain, they dressed her in a set of Beatrice's underclothes, neither the oldest nor the newest she owned, and in a medium good cotton tea dress and a pair of embroidered leather slippers which had always been too good to discard, but too flowery for Beatrice's taste. Beatrice was sorry to lose the tea dress from her adequate but not extensive wardrobe, but understood that the loss meant she had picked correctly, bestowing a gift rather than the abject charity of handing over something only suitable to be discarded. She was also slightly pained that the dress hung loose on the girl, and that its cornflower blue, set against the pale skin and hair, made a colour harmony worthy of a painter's brush, whereas it had only ever looked washed out against her own dark hair. As Beatrice approached, the girl stood and let Abigail gather the back of the dress with a few running stitches, and then tie the sash around to hide the makeshift alteration. She then sat again, and made no sound as Abigail set to work with the comb and fought her way through several nasty knotted tangles. Finally, the hair flowed straight and smooth, and Beatrice stepped in to roll and pin the pale corn silk into a simple, low bun at the nape of the neck. With her hair up, the girl looked less like a frightened child and more like a young woman recently out of the schoolroom. Beatrice judged her to be 17 or so. "What's going on here?" said Mrs. Turber, stepping into the courtyard with a glowering face. "Water all over the floor and a fire blazing like it's November." "Abigail was helping me bathe our guest, Mrs. Turber," said Beatrice. "Just because I offered a roof doesn't mean—" The girl turned to look at her, and Mrs. Turber stopped as suddenly as she had started. "Well, bless me, she's quite the angel, isn't she?" she added, and then did not seem to know what to say next.
Beatrice translated for the girl that the large, red-faced woman thought she looked like an angel. The girl gave a shy smile and stepped forward.
"Non, non, vous êtes un ange, madame," she said quietly. "An angel."
With that, she kissed Mrs. Turber's rough hand.
"Bless me,
she speaks English," said Mrs. Turber, and patted the girl's hand, adding, "You are très welcome dans ma maison, mademoiselle."
"Thank you, chère madame,"
said the girl, her English romantically accented.
"I am Celeste. I am daughter of Professor Fontaine."
"Well, don't just stand there with your mouth open, Abigail," said Mrs. Turber to her dumbfounded maid. "Take Miss Celeste in and get her some breakfast. Make sure you bring her a bowl of the good cream, and perhaps she'd like some smoked haddock and poached eggs."
"Your generosity is unbounded, Mrs. Turber," said Beatrice, as Abigail led Celeste into the house. She wondered if she too was to partake of haddock and cream, or whether her usual breakfast of porridge and toast and the occasional overboiled egg would be served.
"She needs feeding up," said Mrs. Turber, frowning as if Beatrice had failed to see this.
"And she'll be needing better than that rag of a dress, I'm sure. I have some bits put by from when I was younger. I had the waist of a hummingbird, my husband used to say."
"That's my second best tea dress," said Beatrice, distracted by trying to picture any bird with an appreciable waist.
"Well, I'm sure it's perfectly adequate," said Mrs. Turber, giving her a doubtful look. "But Miss Celeste is clearly a girl of great refinement."
She let the thought trail away, and Beatrice had an unworthy urge to drop Aunt Marbley's name in rebuke. The thought made her snappish.
"She is very blonde and lovely," she said. But were fairness the accepted test of rank and refinement, no doubt the royal family would all be albino.
"I was referring to her respectful manners," said Mrs. Turber,
"something some of us could no doubt learn from."
"Touché, Mrs. Turber," said Beatrice. "You were right, of course, and I am a shrew."
"The royal family, indeed," said Mrs. Turber. "I've never been so shocked."
"Then I am doubly sorry, for I know you are a woman who is often shocked, Mrs. Turber," said Beatrice. "I am stiff and grumpy from sleeping on the floor and waking up too early."
"I suppose now you'll be wanting the bed back again," said Mrs. Turber.
Beatrice could think of nothing worse. No doubt the wormy frame and lumpy mattress had been rendered more wormy, lumpy and damp from being kept in Mrs. Turber's cellar and chewed by mice.
"Mrs. Kent has promised to send another bed," said Beatrice. "But if you do have clothing and linens put by, I'm sure Celeste would be deeply indebted for your trouble."
Mrs. Turber brightened considerably at this suggestion.
"I'll alter them for her with my own hands, bless her," she said. "I have a dress or two and some red flannel petticoats that still have years of strength in them. A lady needs good, stout petticoats."
"In all seasons and climates, Mrs. Turber," said Beatrice. As Mrs. Turber bustled into the house, Beatrice grinned. She was surprised to feel a warmth of purpose in being now connected to the great enterprise underway. To provide sanctuary was an ancient tradition, and as long as pride did not become hubris, she must not start talking of my refugee like Mrs. Fothergill. She acknowledged that it felt gratifying to have found some small connection to the war. Mrs. Turber was not the only citizen of Rye to be taken with Celeste. Mrs. Saunders, who did the washing and mending, was summoned after breakfast to take away the spoiled dress. In the passageway, she shook her head at Beatrice over the impossibility of cleaning such fine ruined silk, but when Beatrice brought her into the parlour to explain the matter to Celeste, not wanting to dispose of even this ruined item without consultation, Mrs. Saunders began to weep at the girl's shy shrug of understanding and made tearful promises to do the work of Hercules himself to save the dress.
"Please tell her it does not matter," said Celeste in a whisper to Beatrice. "I shall never wear it again."
"You will, if these hands ever had any skill in learning," said Mrs. Saunders, "and you shall have the lace off it, sure as I'm a good Englishwoman, for I will clean that with the blessed Sunday bread and eat potatoes instead."
Mrs. Saunders must have gone to gossip about Celeste at Pike Brothers' haberdashery department, because not an hour later, Artie's mother knocked at the door to drop in a small sewing kit and several lengths of hair ribbon for the poor young lady. Well, just before lunch, the Mrs. Porter brought one of the nuns to visit, in case the girl had need of spiritual counselling, and presented Celeste with a small jar of their own gooseberry preserves. Lunch itself was interrupted by the arrival of Agatha Kent's man, with the bed in the farm cart, and Celeste looked to Beatrice as if she would drop in limp exhaustion as Smith and the farm boy laboured loudly up the stairs and bumped about, moving the writing desk and knocking the bed together with wooden mallets, while the horse snorted at the open window and then put his head in the window box to nibble on Mrs. Turber's pelargoniums. Beatrice had sent Celeste to rest in her newly curtained nook and was contemplating retiring to her own room, now stripped of its dirty linens, when there was a hideous shriek downstairs and Abigail called her down to receive a freshly killed rabbit that had sent Mrs. Turber into a fit of the vapours. The three boys she tutored had sneaked in through the back gate to knock at the kitchen door with the gift and to ask if the Belgian princess might be induced to wave at them from the upstairs window. "Not to worry," reported Abigail. She had given Snout a box on the ear for his impudence, and sent a lot of them packing. Beatrice suggested that for a girl her size, the boxing of boys' ears was not a safe pursuit.
"He's my big brother, miss," said Abigail. "He knows I'll give him worse than that if he don't mind his manners."
Beatrice was horrified. How had she not seen the family resemblance, the same streak of resolve in the thin faces? How close had she come, several times, to making some remark or giving some warning to Abigail about the boy's family?
"The rabbit is quite a prize," said Beatrice, blushing with confusion. "Please thank your brother for me."
"Best not," said Abigail. "Likely he poached it. He'll come to no good if he's not careful."
"Your brother is quite the scholar," said Beatrice, looking to make amends, if only to appease her own conscience.
"If only he had his mind fixed on the schooling, and not half of it always off in the woods," the young maid replied. "I hope you'll be hard on him, miss. Keep him up to his work."
"Did you like school?" asked Beatrice. If she was as sharp as her brother, it seemed a sorry waste that she should spend her life blacking grates and emptying chamber pots.
"Oh, I loved it, miss," she said, "but too much learning's a waste for a girl like me. I'll be married most likely, and a few years in service, and a bit of money put by, means I'll get to have my pick, rather than have to take potluck. You know how it is."
"It can surely never be a waste to feed one's mind," said Beatrice, shocked but impressed at the girl's practical grasp of her prospects.
"No offence, miss," she said. "That's all well and good for a lady like you, but I'm a farrier's daughter. The husband I'll be after likely won't take kindly to a wife with airs of reading books and such."
"I think you'll find most women in pursuit of a husband share an interest in appearing less educated than they really are," said Beatrice. "It is why I have a low opinion of them."
"Of women, miss?" said Abigail.
"No, of husbands," said Beatrice.
"Maybe I won't need one if my brother does make something fine of himself with all his schooling," said Abigail wistfully. "At least if I kept house for him, I'd know who was in charge, and it wouldn't be him."
Chapter 11. Mr. Tillingham and the Professor were seated on the lawn, two dark silhouettes at a white iron table under the spreading sunlit boughs of an ancient mulberry tree. The tea-urn had not yet been brought out, but a stand of small cakes and a silver platter of thinly sliced bread and butter suggested its imminent arrival. Only the white cloth on the folding side table flapped to break the green and silent tableau. Hugh wondered whether the scene before him was an illusion, or whether the day before, among the suffering refugees on the docks of Folkestone, had been just a dream, for surely the two scenes were from incompatible worlds. When Mr. Tillingham had sent a note that morning inviting Aunt Agatha and her nephews to tea, Hugh had tried gently to suggest that Mr. Tillingham's exhausted refugees should be allowed quiet.
"That is precisely why we must go," said his aunt. "If we decline, there is no knowing whom Mr. Tillingham might invite instead."
"Gentlemen, welcome," said Mr. Tillingham, waving his cane. "I do hope the ladies are en route.
He turned to the professor and added, "This fine weather does tend to make the bread curl, and these days it's a shame to waste good butter."
The professor stood to greet them, and Hugh, who had not paid much attention to him during the long trip from Folkestone, saw that he was not as old a man as he had appeared. In fresh clothing and clean-shaven, he presented a compact but upright figure. He wore a dark tweed jacket over a high-collared white shirt and dull red tie, some dun-coloured flannels pulled in at the waist, and a pair of soft shoes. That his shirt moved independently about the neck showed that it was too big. Hugh assumed from Mr. Tillingham's approving glance that he himself had donated the items, and was not displeased with the professorial effect.
"You look so much better, Professor," said Hugh. "I hope you had a good night's sleep."
"The home of Monsieur Tillingham has provided sanctuary for the body and balm for the soul," said the Professor. "I was just saying that I feel as if returned to civilization from a long expedition to a darker continent."
"You will be shocked at the privations the Professor has endured," said Mr. Tillingham. "I only wonder if they will be too much for the ladies to bear."
"Aunt Agatha and Miss Nash will have words for you if you dare suggest they are too fragile for such stories," said Daniel, casually removing a slice of bread from the tea-table and settling in a chair to munch on it.
"But perhaps the professor's daughter will not like to relive such difficulties," said Hugh. "How is your daughter, sir?"
"I have not yet seen her. It was better for her to rest," said the professor, "for though I shielded her as much as any father could, my poor child, she has glimpsed d'erreur."
"Heroic," said Mr. Tillingham, stroking his chin.
"The learned man stands against the brutish horde. It is an ancient theme."
"I visited the hostel today," said Hugh. "Some of your compatriots report great difficulty sleeping. Dr. Lawton and I had to prescribe sleeping draughts to several."
"I'm not surprised. They are undone," the professor sighed.
"To the peasant, the loss of a few possessions and the eviction from home, I am sure it feels as large to them as it does to persons of real property. Yet even my own not inconsiderable losses must be of no account against the destruction of civilization to which I was witness."
"The Germans burned the ancient library at the professor's university," said Mr. Tillingham. "If we needed any further proof that civilization stands in the breach..."
"I was able to persuade the commanding officer to save some of the rarest volumes," said the professor. "But even he, an educated gentleman to whom I could beg for reason, he could not keep his troops from putting the buildings to the flame." He produced a large handkerchief from his pocket and turned aside his face. Hugh felt some doubt as to whether the burning of books should be counted a greater crime than forcing poor families from their homes at Bayonet Point. And the suffering he had witnessed on the docks had seemed to make no distinction between rich and poor. But he held his tongue. He did not think the present company would welcome a debate on such questions, for he had no doubt that spirited debate was the first casualty of any war. For Beatrice, the opening of Mr. Tillingham's front door was the opening of the temple. Stepping in behind Agatha Kent and Celeste, she could already smell the books, even above the waxy note of wood polish and the hint of recently baked cakes from the unseen kitchen. Leather-bound books, old books with yellowed pages, new books with the sharp scent of printer's ink and the promise of crisp, uncut pages awaiting the paper knife. Pamphlets and chapbooks in boxes, clean paper awaiting the typewriter or pen. She could feel a familiarity and a tiny, tremulous awakening of a hope that she belonged in this tiled hall, these high-ceilinged parlours. Might Mr. Tillingham indeed invite her to use his library? Might not Mr. Tillingham's secretary experience a sudden temporary illness, and Beatrice be allowed to step in and assist as she had done so often for her father? Might the great man, in his gratitude, not then take an avuncular interest in her writings as he already did for Daniel? For a moment, Beatrice allowed her mind to indulge in these happy thoughts, and to feel a glow of possibility that she had not felt since losing her father. Her reverie was interrupted by Celeste, whose grip upon her arm tightened. The girl trembled violently, and her face was once again pale. Beatrice was reminded sharply that the pleasures of at last reaching Mr. Tillingham's inner sanctum were purchased on the back of much loss and distress, and that it was foolish of them all to subject the girl to a garden full of strangers.
"Courage, ma petite," said Beatrice, patting Celeste's hand. "We go to see your papa."
At tea, the professor and Mr. Tillingham held forth at length about conditions in Belgium. Beatrice gently refused a second cup of tea, and was glad when Agatha whispered that she was welcome to slip away from the table to admire the gardens. She had stopped to peer at a blousy purple clematis flower, which spread its velvet petals against the old brick of the garden wall, when Daniel, smoking a foul-smelling cigarillo, and Hugh came strolling along the narrow path.
"A more sentimental picture for the artist could hardly be imagined," said Daniel, nodding his head across the lawn towards the professor and his daughter.
The professor inhabited his chair like a wicker throne, thought Beatrice, and Celeste, seated on a low wicker stool at his side, her hand on his sleeve, her skirts pooling on the grass, her body twisted slightly to his and her face tilted up, looked like a supplicating princess. The professor, rendered perhaps more heroic by her air of adoration, was still lecturing, and Agatha Kent and Mr. Tillingham were settled in attitudes of the closest attention.
"Perhaps to be titled Respite from the Storm,
or The Grateful Guests," he added. "She does make a compelling case for an immediate call to arms."
"Must you always be so mocking?" asked Hugh, looking grim. "They have lost their home, their country, everything. The desperation we witness at the port is beyond anything we have imagined."
"At least they have each other," said Beatrice. "Her father is everything to her." Her own voice developed an unwanted tremor as she spoke.
"Somber thoughts for such a lovely afternoon," said Hugh. "I do not make light of their suffering," said Daniel. "It is just human nature to be more interested in fighting to rescue beautiful young maidens. I am ready to run to the recruiter, if only she will drop her handkerchief."
"If she dropped her handkerchief, no doubt you would be too lazy to even pick it up," said Hugh.
"You are right," said Daniel with a sigh. "But I may feel a poem coming on."
"Miss Nash, it does you much credit to have taken in the young lady," said Hugh. "I think they ask too much of you."
"Aunt Agatha could take her," said Daniel. "Then we would see her every day at breakfast, Hugh."
"Forgive my cousin," said Hugh. "He is only playing the fool."
"Really?" asked Beatrice. "He is so convincing."
"The balloon of my pride is thus pierced by the steel pin of your wit, Miss Nash," said Daniel. "I shall deflate in a suitable chair."
He set off at a fast clip to make a second assault upon the cake stand.
"Not many ladies would be so ready to share their home," said Hugh as they slowly followed Daniel back to the tea table. "You are to be admired."
Beatrice felt a small glow of pleasure at such a compliment from the serious Hugh. But when she turned her smile towards him, she saw he was absorbed in studying Celeste, and frowning at Daniel, who had pulled up a chair to engage her in conversation. Her pleasure died, and she crushed her own injured feelings with a sharp response.
"It was quite selfish on my part," she said. "Don't you know that it is deeply fashionable to take in a refugee?"
"No one could ever suspect you of being fashionable," said Hugh.
"Just what a woman wants to hear," said Beatrice with a sigh.
Hugh stopped in his tracks to face her, his eyes anxious.
"By which I mean only that no one, I do not mean, oh my goodness, Miss Nash."
"I am teasing you, Mr. Grange," said Beatrice, satisfied to have demanded his full attention, but sorry to have succumbed to her own vanity.
"I thank you for your faith in my altruism."
She was also painfully aware that she might not have been altogether altruistic in acceding to Mr. Tillingham's request for help. However, she was now up to her neck in a responsibility both serious and of an indeterminate length, and therefore she was rather a saint whether she liked it or not.
"Hugh, please,"
said Hugh.
Hugh, she replied. She seems calm, said Hugh, looking again at Celeste. Did she sleep?
Not well, said Beatrice, but I assume any nightmares will abate now she is safe.
These people have seen things no civilized person expects to see in their country town, said Hugh. I fear neurasthenia in some and ongoing nightmares, even in the strongest of them.
What can we do? Asked Beatrice.
Just observe her closely, said Hugh. Treat her as one might a recent invalid. Plenty of hot, sweet tea or beef broth, fresh air, rest, and call on Dr. Lawton if you need a sleeping draught for her.
Thank you, said Beatrice. And will you come and check on us? He looked at her for a moment, and she could not read his face. Was there some mention of cream tea? She added, smiling.
I haven't told my aunt and cousin yet, but I may not be in Sussex for much longer, said Hugh.
He hesitated, and then, lowering his voice, he added, I am going to London tomorrow to enlist. You can't mean it. Beatrice sat down abruptly on a small rustic bench under the garden wall. I mean, I thought soldiering was for the Harry Wheatons of the world. You have so much important work to do.
I'll be furthering that work, said Hugh. Just under the auspices of the Royal Army Medical Corps.
But what about your surgeon? She asked. Does he not count on you?
He is leading the charge, said Hugh. He offered me more patience and more experience to be had on the battlefield, and the chance to do my duty while furthering my own career.
His lip twisted in apparent distaste. An irresistible combination, I should think, said Beatrice slowly.
And yet every sense revolted against the idea of it, said Hugh.
He sat beside her.
To go to war for the advancement of one's career seemed wrong somehow.
And your surgeon's daughter, she asked. Surely she must have suffered at the idea. To her surprise, she felt a bitter sorrow that he would be in harm's way, and she chided herself for being such a poor patriot as to wish her own acquaintances exempt from service.
Miss Lucy has such enthusiasm for recruiting that Lord Kitchener should put her entreating eyes on a poster, said Hugh. Out of loyalty and affection, I suppose I must allow her to claim me as her recruit. He gazed across the lawn at the professor and Celeste. But in truth, it was going to the docks yesterday that changed my mind. The dozens of refugees, the wounded, the chaos.
His voice trailed away, and she could see in his eyes that he was replaying pictures of the scene. I imagine it was very difficult, said Beatrice. But as she spoke, she knew she could not imagine. The exhaustion, dirty clothes, and pungent smell of the few refugees crowded into the town hall had been overwhelming enough.
Grandmothers with bleeding feet from walking for days in wooden clogs, he said, his voice brimming with emotion. Babies thrust into the arms of complete strangers just to get them to safety. Women desperate for news of detained husbands, pinning their information to every fence.
He paused, and then shook his head as if to clear the images from his mind.
All other considerations melted away, and I knew I had to go where I can be at least useful.
No one who knows you would doubt that duty is uppermost in your mind, said Beatrice. They will all be proud of you.
Thank you for your kindness, he said.
He held out his hand, and she gave him hers to clasp.
I know you always speak your mind, Miss Nash, and therefore I value your kind words all the more. I hope I have not offended you with my descriptions.
I appreciate your frankness, she said. She looked over to the tea table, where Agatha was laughing at some remark of Daniel's. She knew the pain Hugh's news would bring. When will you tell your aunt? She asked.
No sooner than I have to, he said.
Chapter 12. Two letters arrived on Beatrice's breakfast tray, one from Lady Marbury's solicitors, and one from her father's publisher, Mr. Carraway. She set them aside on the small table while she ate, in order to prolong the pleasing sense of anticipation that all her worries both financial and aspirational, might be laid to rest. A week or so after Celeste's arrival, she had written to Aunt Marbley with a polite request that she be allowed to draw a slightly larger monthly allowance from her trust, now that she was participating, in a modest way, in the war relief efforts of the town. With much chewing of her pen over the need to combine modesty with selflessness, she had described the recent taking in of her young refugee, and all the patriotic teas, committees, and events which they would be expected to attend, at some considerable increase in her personal expenses. She enlarged shamelessly upon the famous Mr. Tillingham's gratitude, embroidered upon Lady Emily's continuing patronage, and made sure to mention in passing that Agatha Kent's husband was intimately connected to the highest echelons of government, describing a life of almost missionary simplicity, yet one in which an increase in dress allowance was vital to maintaining a suitable reputation. The finished document was so satisfyingly manipulative that she was forced to bargain with her pricking conscience, promising to make up for such amorality at a later date. As she ate her porridge and sliced a green apple, she tried to concentrate her excitement on the envelope from the publisher, which was too thin to contain a returned manuscript and therefore promised an answer to her literary dreams. But she was distracted by the fat one from the solicitors, which might contain a bank draft. Setting aside literature, she spent a pleasant moment choosing between purchasing a straw hat of Agatha Kent quality and buying a 3-volume set of the works of Jane Austen, bound in dark blue Morocco and hand-tooled gilt, which she coveted at the local bookshop. She was grinning, in rueful self-awareness that the books would always win against personal adornment, as she ripped open the heavy envelope. The letter and enclosed agreement were thick with legal terms, and yet even as she struggled to decipher the words with accuracy, she understood enough to feel a flush of rage in her cheeks. It appeared that, upon Lady Marbley's suggestion, the executors felt it necessary to maintain a paternal watch over a woman of such tender years. There was language as to the limited feminine capacity for financial matters and to the loyalty to family honour, the upshot of which seemed to be that, in order to provide an increase in her allowance, they intended to engage a local solicitor to oversee her financial life, and that she would be expected to deposit her salary with